Und Bill hat immer gesagt, er sei auch.
And Bill always said that he also went to the Bauhaus to find clarity. And that is a process. You don't just have clarity, you have to earn it.
Man muss sich das erarbeiten. Angela Thomas.
I'm Angela Thomas. Max Bill was married twice, and I was his second and last wife and widow.
Aus dieser Tatsache heraus.
Since not much had been done to mark the 100th anniversary of Max Bill's birth, and because I felt he deserved more, I made this film.
Dann habe ich diesen Film gemacht. Mein Name ist Erich Schmid.
My name is Erich Schmid. I come from a journalism background.
He eventually managed to find four former Bauhauslers to come to him to teach classes. And also he asks Walter Gropius for permission to use the name Bauhaus Ulm. My name is Martin Menteler, and I work as the head of the HFG Archiv, the archive of the former Ulm School of Design.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. First of all, thank you all so much for all of your warm, praising comments, be it on Spotify, on YouTube, or on Instagram. Your messages mean so much to me. They are the fuel that keep me going on and on. You have given me so much tailwind that I immediately sat down to write and produce a new episode to provide you with new Bauhaus material even faster this time. Please keep on rating Bauhaus Faces with 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and keep recommending it to whoever might be interested. And if you want to send me comments on episodes or suggest Bauhauslers for new episodes, send me a DM on Instagram, comment an episode or write an email to bauhausfaces@gmail.com. For this brand new episode, I traveled to Zumikon to visit Angela Thomas and Erich Schmid in their house. And this house is none other than what is known today as Max Bill House. This house, which looks somehow unremarkable from the outside, but is amazingly light, open and welcoming on the inside, was built by the Swiss architect and designer Max Bill in 1967-68. His second wife and widow, Angela Thomas, lives there today with her husband, the filmmaker Erich Schmid, who made a film about Bill entitled Max Bill, das absolute Augenmaß, which could be translated to Max Bill, the master's vision. Max Bill established himself in art history as the architect and first director of the Hochschule für Gestaltung in Ulm, also known as HFG Ulm or, in English, the Ulm School of Design. And that is exactly the reason why I also interviewed the head of the HFG Ulm archive, Martin Menteler, regarding all questions around the official successor of the Bauhaus. Because that is what Bill intended to do in Ulm, to continue the Bauhaus, as if it had never been closed in 1933. And he had Walter Gropius's blessing too, and the financial support by the Americans. As you see, there's so much we have to talk about. I conducted the interview with Angela Thomas and Erich Schmid in German. For the English dubbing, I asked, once again, Konrad Feininger to take the male part in this podcast. Thank you, Konrad, for once again lending us your wonderful voice and your precious time. Angela Thomas's part is dubbed by yours truly, me, Anja. It is all to your own advantage, though, because once more, you will get 2 bonus episodes out of it. One is the original, much longer interview with Angela and Erich at Max Bill House in German. The other one is the conversation with Martin Menteler about the HFG Ulm. In this episode that you will be now listening to, I only included those parts about the HFG that concern Max Bill. You should definitely not miss listening to the whole interview, though, that covers the whole history of the Bauhaus successor, the parallels and differences, the architecture, and the design icons. This interview is in English, and although we had so many technical problems recording it online, we bravely made it through the odds together. So, watch out for those 2 bonus episodes, which I will publish next week and the week after that. Let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Max Bill. So before Max Bill was born and before his father got married, his father lived in Switzerland in the mountains on the Jungfraujoch railway, surrounded by beautiful nature and mountain air. When he got married, he moved to Winterthur and became deputy manager of Winterthur Central Station. Max Bill grew up right next to the station in a house owned by the railway company, literally right next to the tracks. His parents' house has since been demolished. Max Bill's mother was the one who had more of an artistic flair at home. One of her brothers, Ernst Geiger, first studied at ETH Zurich and became a forester, but after graduating he became a painter and had a great influence on Bill as a child, giving him his first paint box. Ernst Geiger exhibited in Switzerland alongside important, renowned artists of the time, such as Giacometti, Sigantini, and Kuno Amiet. So he was quite someone. He also supported Bill when he wanted to go to the Bauhaus. His father was also interested in art and went to the Museum of Winterthur with Bill. But the artistic streak came more clearly from his mother's side. In Switzerland, there's not only the place of birth, but also the place of citizenship. This means if you become impoverished, you are sent back to your place of citizenship and they are then obliged to feed you. That has changed a bit today. But in terms of his place of citizenship, Bill was a citizen of the canton of Bern, from the municipality of Mooseedorf, even though he was born in Winterthur. So he had a fatherland and a motherland. His mother came from Brook in the canton of Aargau. Because for the Swiss, the cantons are very important, belonging to a canton. As a young man, Max Bill attended the School of Applied Arts in Zurich and began an apprenticeship as a gold and silversmith, which he did not complete because he was expelled from school for coming to school one day without removing his makeup after Carnival, and for taking other liberties. However, he was very talented, and his first functional objects, today we would call them design objects, were exhibited as early as 1925 at the Exposition Internationale des Arts Décoratifs et Industriels Modernes in Paris. At that time in the exhibition, Sophie Teuber was on the jury, Sophie Teuber-Arp, who taught at the School of Applied Arts in Zurich. Bill knew her because he studied at that school, but he didn't take classes with her directly because she taught the textile class. And so, not quite 17 years old, he went to Paris for the first time, where his objects were exhibited. It was, of course, wonderful for a young person to receive that kind of recognition. And when he was in Paris, he saw Malenkov's pavilion, the Soviet pavilion, which impressed him greatly, and Le Corbusier's. And then he decided that he actually wanted to become an architect, because it had impressed him so much. While in Zurich, he happened to find a book about the Bauhaus in a bookshop owned by Gilsberger. He decided that he would go there to continue his education. So he didn't have a degree and he didn't have a high school diploma. He once said that if he had had a high school diploma, he would have liked to study geology, because his uncle, who was a painter, also went on excursions in the Swiss countryside. He hiked from his hometown of Brook to Solio, literally across the mountains, and wrote his doctoral thesis on the Bergell region. So he had a strong connection to materials, and Bill did too. When Bill placed objects somewhere, they had a special aura. Not everyone has that ability.
Dann haben die eine spezielle Aura gehabt. Das kann nicht jeder. Seine Mutter hat sich scheiden lassen.
His mother divorced his father. That was also in April 1927, when he moved from Zurich to the Bauhaus in Dessau.
Ans Bauhaus ging nach Dessau.
Also, du hast einmal gesagt.
So, you once said that Bill's parents were constantly arguing until they got divorced, and that he wanted to get away from this arguing, as far away as possible. That certainly played a part.
Das hat sicher etwas mitgespielt.
Hatte damals an einem Wettbewerb teilgenommen.
At the time, Bill had entered a competition for Suchard Chocolat, the chocolate company. The competition entries were submitted anonymously, and he won first prize. He then told me that the judges had probably assumed that the design had been created by one of his teachers at the art school. So he was just incredibly lucky and got quite a lot of money and told his father that he would finance half of his Bauhaus studies himself and his father would pay the other half. But afterwards, Bill ended up quite indebted to his father. The money was simply never enough. Let's stop here for a second and look at this competition entry from 1925 for Suchard Chocolat. What we have here is a promotional poster for the chocolate company. Let me shortly describe Max Bill's design. The black elegant Art Deco lettering Suchard Chocolat 1826 to 1926 is mounted on a golden background and framed by six strong red lines. The poster is divided into seven parts, of which only the top and bottom parts are a little wider than the other five parts. In the second, fourth, and sixth part, the lettering finds its place. In the four sections above, between, and below the lettering, Bill inserted stylized branches of an undefined tree, maybe an olive tree. The poster design is so simple yet intriguing. It puts the chocolate factory into a bright, elegant light. It is this competition entry that bestows Max Bill with a good amount of money, which will provide the financial basis for his studies at the Bauhaus, which Bill begins in Dessau in April 1927. And that was the same year that the left-wing Basel architect Hannes Meyer came to the Bauhaus in Dessau and the actual architecture department officially started. Walter Gropius left the Bauhaus in 1928, and Bill, like everyone else who came to the Bauhaus, had to take the preliminary course first, even though he had almost completed his apprenticeship. And that was with Joseph Albers. And it was very important because Albers taught the students this aesthetic and ethical principles and that you have to take responsibility for the products you release into society. You have to be able to justify them. And Bill later tried to convey this to the students at the Ulm School of Design, which he designed and where he was the first rector. His students then had to defend their design products to industry and assert their position in the literal sense. After this basic course with Albers, Bill briefly joined Laszlo Moholy Nagy's metal workshop and was also invited to Lucia's and Laszlo's master's house. But he didn't stay there long because he already knew how to do metal work professionally. He already had the manual skills. He then went to both Paul Klee and Vasily Kandinsky's free painting classes, and he could speak Swiss German with Klee, which the Germans naturally didn't understand. They had a kind of microcosm of their own language there. It was a special bond. Bill's style at the Bauhaus was also quite close to Klee's, but he quickly moved away from it after leaving the Bauhaus. For example, the Wellrelief, wave relief, we have hanging here from 1930-31. That's completely Bill, completely his own style. And apart from these free painting classes, he was also at the Bauhaus stage with Oskar Schlemmer in 1928. And he said that was the workshop where you could, of course, be most free.
Die Werkstatt, wo man sich natürlich am freisten betätigen konnte.
Ich kenne kein Werk, was er gemacht hat am Bauhaus, außer diesen Zeichnungen.
I don't know of any major works Bill did at the Bauhaus, except for these drawings, which are obviously inspired by Paul Klee. They are almost indistinguishable from Klee's drawings. But I find these Bauhaus drawings to be very biographical in nature. When he portrays Kat Bot and Hilde Ranch smoking cigarettes together, it says something about his relationship with these women. Hilde Ranch was also in Switzerland, working with Gunther Stoetzel. Ranch was a fellow Bauhaus student of Max Bill. She then disappeared. Apparently, she returned to Germany. We did a little research. She lived here and moved many times, which suggests that the immigration authorities did not leave her alone. We would really like to find out more about this. But let's get back to the works. For me, they are more biographical statements than, say, works that show Max Bill's new beginning or what he then made of himself.
Das zeigen, was er dann aus sich selber gemacht hat.
I find the little king of whiners funny because he's also self-deprecating. And Bill was not a sentimental person. And the fact that, as said, he drew the two girlfriends together, Kat Bord and Hilde Runge. He told me that during his time at the Bauhaus, he was in love with four women. And the fact that he gave Klee a painting of a hermaphrodite for his 60th birthday also shows me the certain freedom that people had at the Bauhaus, because I can't imagine him giving his father, who was more of a carrot and stick type, a hermaphrodite for his birthday. And I often ask myself what would have happened. I mean, who among us had such great masters as teachers as they did at the Bauhaus? No one else did. And if Bill hadn't had them, he once said to me, and quite credibly, he could have just easily have become a gangster. But he had a good education.
Aber er hat ein gutes Bildungsangebot gehabt. Da Bill nicht offiziell.
Bill wasn't accepted into the architecture department because he hadn't completed the metal workshop. Because you first had to complete a basic apprenticeship and only then could you be accepted into the architecture department. But he somehow managed to attend Mats Damm's courses on building statics. Mats Damm was a Dutch left-wing architect who taught at the Bauhaus and whom Gropius had even considered as his successor. But Stamm declined. Bill had a connection to him. And Stamm even visited him in Switzerland after World War II. Kat Bord was one of his fellow students and she studied in the architecture department. And Bill definitely knew Lotte Bese even back then, who was also studying architecture at the Bauhaus. I once took a photo of the two of them in later years when they met at the Bauhaus archive, where they greeted each other so warmly. People always talk about the Bauhaus family in general, but of course there were different emotional relationships. And I would say that the relationship between Bill and Stamm and Bese was a very strong one. I also know that Bill, although he wasn't involved in architecture, nevertheless took part in architecture competitions, including one in Osaka, Japan, where he was the only Western architect to submit an entry. And then there was another project in collaboration with Hans Fischli. At that time, with Osaka, the house he designed was a multi-story house with a roof terrace. He had this Japanese fellow student, Takehiko Mitsutani, who received Japanese architecture magazines himself and who then put the captions in Japanese for him. And he also made sculptures that were very close to what Bill did later. If you are a regular listener of Bauhaus Faces, you maybe remember that we have mentioned Takehiko Mitsutani in the podcast episode about Michiko and Iwao Yamawaki too. There's nearly nothing left of Mitsutani's work, who, like Max Bill, started studying at the Bauhaus in April 1927. He was a qualified architect already when he came to the Bauhaus. Max Bill's connection to several Bauhauslers who were part of the building workshop. They've all studied first with Hannes Meyer, and when he became director of the Bauhaus in April of 1928, the Swiss architect Hans Witwer, who had very successfully worked together with Meyer back in their hometown of Basel, took over. Through them, Max Bill must have developed some kind of knowledge and skill about architecture. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to design a multi-story building and even be recognized for his entry. Mitsutani left the Bauhaus nearly 1 year after Max Bill, in September 1929. His brass sheet sculpture from the preliminary course with Joseph Albers, that Angela just talked about, is today part of the collection of the Bauhaus archive in Berlin. The sculpture is one of the most beautiful objects that are left from the Bauhaus. I must admit, it is one of my all-time favorites. Mitsutani's sculpture is constructed of three thin, bent brass sheets interconnected with each other. The effect is an elegant dynamic in all directions, culminating in a shell-like curvature. It is so beautiful. I will link a short video about the sculpture and a beautiful photo of it in the show notes for you, so you can see for yourselves. Angela also mentioned that the sculpture by Takehiko Mitsutani sort of foreshadows Max Bill's own later work. Of course, I won't just leave you guys hanging with that statement. This needs at least a short explanation. But you will need to wait for some more time until we get to Max Bill's concrete art. I can tell you for now, though, that Bill will become one of the most important representatives of the Zurich concrete artists, and that he will create numerous beautiful sculptures during his life, which are so reminiscent of Takehiko Mitsutani's sculpture. Perhaps this is why, at the end of his life, Bill was awarded the Premium Imperiale for Sculpture, by the Emperor of Japan himself. Let us now go back to Angela and Erich to hear how things further developed for Max Bill at the Bauhaus. Since he officially left the Bauhaus in November of 1928 for financial reasons, due to a lack of money, Bill was doing one exercise on the Bauhaus stage when a fellow student who was on a trapeze punched him in the face, knocking out several of his teeth. The accident at the Bauhaus stage had caused such high dental costs that Bill ended up in debt to his father. So from here, he also left without a diploma. Therefore, in a way, you could say that Bill was self-taught, even though he had excellent teachers, excellent masters.
Lehrer hatte hervorragende Meister. Also Hannes Meyer hat dann ja eine Bauhausbrigade gemacht.
So Hannes Meyer then formed a Bauhaus brigade that went to the Soviet Union. And Max Bill wanted to go with the one with Max Stamm and Ernst May, the Frankfurt City architect. He applied as an advertising technician in 1930, and this is also related to the fact that when Bill came to the Bauhaus in April of 1927, the Russian painter Kazimir Malevich was also visiting the Bauhaus and would have liked to teach there, but he didn't speak German. And Bill always told me that there was a library, but you had to go through Gropius's office to get there, so it was like a barrier. But in the canteen, there were newspapers with Russian and Polish writing and pictures. He couldn't read them, but he saw the pictures, which were black and white at the time. And he realized from these pictures that they were further ahead in the USSR than they were at the Bauhaus. And that's why he wanted to go there. And of course, after the 1917 revolution, what was happening there was a great fascination for young people anyway. And as I said, he applied to the brigade in the summer of 1930, and Stamm replied that the brigade was already full. Hans Schmidt was also there, with whom Bill later became friends and was well acquainted, and with whom he also worked to some extent. Hans Schmidt's wife then did in the Soviet Union what Bill would have liked to do, but was rejected. Those were the attachments. And as a young person, seeing through the different structures, the whole range of what is available, and then also learning for yourself, is very time-consuming and very difficult. And Bill always said that he also went to the Bauhaus to gain clarity, and that is a process. You don't simply have clarity, you have to work for it. So there are different layers. There were also different ideologies at the Bauhaus. It took some time until you got through them.
Verschiedene Ideologien am Bauhaus, ne? Und eben bis man da durchsteigt.
Das Bauhaus kann man ja nicht losgelöst von der Zeit sehen.
The Bauhaus cannot be regarded in isolation from its time. Because there was National Socialism, which was on the rise and also found its way into the Bauhaus, and there were certainly internal struggles. And Hannes Meyer was, of course, a communist, one might say. Well, perhaps not yet at the Bauhaus, but certainly a dedicated leftist, and they really wanted to experience the dawn of a new era and the workers' paradise in the Soviet Union. And there was also no work for architects in Germany. That was another factor, of course, and it must have been very polarized.
Muss einfach wirklich auch sehr polarisiert gewesen sein.
Das Jahr 1929, was Bill da gemacht.
In 1929, what Bill did there is a black hole or white hole. No one knows for sure. And I also assume that he was still at the Bauhaus from time to time, without paying tuition fees. And he was definitely in Berlin in 1929 because he placed advertisements in an anarchist newspaper saying that he was looking for work, only very modern architecture. He did one for Dessau and one for Zurich, which means he would have gone where he could have worked, I would conclude. This year, 1929, it is the year that followed Max Bill's departure from the Bauhaus. And I wouldn't be me if I hadn't asked myself if Bill could have been involved or at least familiar with the Bauhaus building project of the trade union school in Bernau. You know my affiliation to Bernau by now, I guess. Angela told me that Bill was not only in Berlin in 1929, but that he was also good friends with Ari Scharon. And Sharon, you might know from my Bauhaus Faces episode about him with his grandson Ariel Aloni, was the site manager of the teachers' houses that were part of the Bernau School and head of the architecture office by Hannes Meyer in Berlin that was set up for the sole purpose of building the trade union school. Sharon became head of the office after Hans Witwer left the Bauhaus and with it the Bernau project in early 1929. So there's a chance that Bill was well informed about this particular project. Also, the whole competition that was won by the Bauhaus was published in the Bauhaus magazine when Max Bill was still at the Bauhaus in 1928. And I'm pretty sure that it was presented as a prime example of modern architecture at the Bauhaus. Plus, the students of the building department, some of whom Bill befriended, worked day and night with Hans Witwer to finish the competition papers, as we know from one of Hans Witwer's letters to his fiancée. You might rightly ask why Anja must always bring up the trade union school in nearly every podcast episode of Bauhaus Faces. Bear with me, because this has an important reason. Max Bill will later, in the early 1950s, design a whole new building for the HFG Ulm that became the official successor of the Bauhaus after World War II. And that building, believe it or not, just looks so much like the trade union school in Bernau. There are many parallels, like the concrete binders which hold the whole building skeleton and determine the whole harmonic rhythm of the architecture. Different building parts of the various necessities and a passageway that combines them all, albeit there was no money left in Ulm to construct a glass shell around it like in Bernau. If you're interested in this topic, you should definitely listen to my conversation with Martin Mentele in the bonus episode about the HFG Ulm, in which we discussed this in more detail. Later in 1929, Max Bill returned to Switzerland, installing in Zurich. Here, he fell in love with Maria Benz, a French actress. They met at Café Odeon, and Max Bill baptized her Nusch, according to Paul Hindemith's opera Das Nusch Nuschi, The Nusch Nuschi, subtitled A Play for Burmese Marionettes in One Act from 1921. I guess it was Maria Benz's profession that inspired the nickname. In our interview, Angela told me some more about the relationship between Bill and Nusch. That I even know about Maria Benz, whom Max Bill nicknamed Nusch, that's only because Max Bill told me himself, because she was really very important in his life. She was his first great love before he met his first wife, Binja. He actually wanted to marry Nusch because she was a foreigner in Switzerland. She came from Mühlhaus in France and worked here in Zurich as a model for the Grieder fashion house, modeling clothes, but she didn't have a work permit. She kept getting summonses from the immigration police and would have been expelled. To prevent that, and because Bill was fascinated by her anyway, they wanted to get married. They lived together in a concubinage on Stadelhoferstraße, which was also forbidden. So they posted their notice of marriage, announcing that they were planning to get married. Bill then wrote a letter to his father, saying that they had known each other for about 6 months and that she had also worked for him. He had had a few typography and design jobs for Western Switzerland and didn't speak French very well himself, so she helped him. And then his father wrote back to him saying that this soubrette was out of the question. Where his father got this idea from? Someone must have told him that this woman had a bad reputation or something. But because Bill was so deeply in debt at that time, he didn't have the chance to stand up to his father and do it anyway. I know he met Nusch again at the Obed in Strasbourg. He had his first collector at the time, Wasma was his name, and he had some cash, which he was able to give to Nusch. And Nusch then went to Paris, and we know that she happened to meet René Char and Paul-Éluard on the pavement. She then became the companion of Éluard, who had just been left by Gala, his wife, who was with Salvador Dalí, and then stayed with Dalí. Nusch kept the nickname Bill had given her, and Éluard and Nusch also came back to Switzerland later, shortly before her death, and Bill saw her again there.
Und Elia und Nusch kamen auch spät, noch kurz vor ihrem Tod, auch noch mal in die Schweiz, und da hat Bill sie auch noch mal wieder gesehen. Nach dem Bauhaus war auch Paris das Zentrum gewesen.
After the Bauhaus, Paris was also the center that gave him the most and where he also gave a great deal, because there was this international group of artists called Abstraction, Création, Art non figuratif, which he joined as a young man on the recommendation of Sophie Teuber-Arp and Hans Arp. He was 25 years old at the time. That was in 1933. And he went to Piet Mondrian's studio. He also met Georges Fantongalo there, who became his lifelong friend a little later. This group really included the most important artists of the time, Sonia Delaunay with her husband, Barbara Hepworth with her husband. I'll turn it around because otherwise the husbands are always mentioned first and then the wives. All the wonderful sculptor Katarzyna Kobro from Poland and her husband Strzemiński, the painter. And this group also included Bill's former Bauhaus masters Kandinsky, Albers and Molinoc. And the former student was accepted there as an equal.
Auf Augenhöhe akzeptiert. Die Jeanne Boucher, das war eine Galeristin in Paris.
Jeanne Boucher was a gallery owner in Paris and also very important during the resistance. Her gallery was essentially the mailbox for resistance messages. And Bill went there with his stack of watercolors, which still had this clay influence. He went to Jeanne Boucher and thought he could exhibit right away. And she said, "You're a young, talented man. Come back in a year with your own work. We all love Paul Klee." So she gave him a kick in the butt, the right advice at the right time, and I'm sure he was completely horrified and frustrated at first. But he took it to heart, recognized what it meant, and then very quickly developed his own style. The group Abstraction Création that was founded in 1931 in Paris by the Belgian painter, sculptor and architect Georges Fantongalo, who would become one of Bill's lifelong friends, was a unison of modern artists. Their aim was to found a forum for abstract art. They organized joint exhibitions, lectures, discussions and publications. Between 1932, when Bill joined the group, and 1937, when the group dissolved, they published 5 numbers of the almanac Abstraction, Création, Art non figuratif, in which they did a great deal of theoretical and methodological groundwork for non-representational art. The publicly effective work of Abstraction, Création contributed significantly to increasing the social recognition of abstract art. It would be the basis for Max Bill's development of his own art, what he called concrete art, a term close to the name of an art group around Theo van Doesburg called Art Concret from 1930. Bill defined his own art as concrete art for the first time in an exhibition catalogue of the Kunsthaus Zurich in 1936 with the following words. "We refer to those works of art as concrete art that have been created using their own inherent means and principles, without external reference to natural phenomena or their transformation, which means not through abstraction. Concrete art is independent in its uniqueness. It is the expression of the human spirit, intended for the human spirit, and it should be characterized by the sharpness, clarity, and perfection that must be expected of works of the human spirit." Max Bill became one of the leading figures of concrete art in Zurich and was highly successful with his sculptures and paintings. Those are the sculptures that remind me of Takehiko Mizutani's focus piece from the Bauhaus. One of the most impressive examples of Bill's concrete art is the sculpture Continuität, Continuity. It all started when Bill was asked to design a form for an industrial exhibition in London, which should be placed in front of an electric fireplace. The sculpture was not completed on time and was then presented at the Triennale di Milano in 1936, where it was hung as a loop over a column. It is essentially a Möbius loop, a mathematical object with only one side and one edge. Bill created the sculpture more than once. One that was installed in Zurich was destroyed by a group of right-wing extremists. Today, there's still a huge sculpture in Frankfurt am Main, made of granite. The story of the production of this continuity sculpture is adventurous. Erich Schmid tells it in his film about Bill with original video footage. I asked Erich to further explain for us what concrete art is.
Also in der konkreten Kunst, würde ich sagen, ist nicht alles sofort sichtbar, was Kunst ist.
In concrete art, I would say that not everything that is art is immediately visible. So it may not be so easily accessible. Concrete art is simply beautiful to most people who view it because it works with colors and shapes. It is not figurative. It does not depict anything that we can recognize from our everyday lives. So, it is not a representation of nature, but rather a representation of an idea. It is, so you could say, a pictorial or three-dimensional representation of a philosophy, perhaps. Or at least of an idea that is then translated into an external representation. I walked past this picture hanging in the living room for about a year and simply thought it was beautiful, but I didn't give it much thought. And at some point, I just wanted to get to the bottom of Max Bill's inner spiritual trade secret. And I suddenly saw in this picture that these colored lines are all diagonals, diagonals of rectangles that you can't see, that are invisible. And in the middle, there are two diagonals that intersect at right angles. That can only be a square. So I had to look for this square, and I found it. And it hangs diagonally in this picture at the same angle as the whole picture in the square on the tip. And one sideline of this inner square, which you can't see, is 1 meter long. And the whole picture, which is also a square on the tip, has a side length of 2 meters. Then you can also imagine axes running through this picture. Perhaps, in other words, concrete art is not immediately recognizable and requires the viewer to engage with it.
Und sie erfordert den Betrachter und die Betrachterin, sich damit auseinanderzusetzen. Also man muss sich einfach vorstellen, die Schweiz war eingekesselt.
So you have to imagine that Switzerland was surrounded from 1940 onwards. And before that, society was simply very polarized. Hitler had come to power, and I would say that the majority of Swiss people didn't really care about politics. They didn't go to the polls. Even today, when there are referendums, only 40% to 50% of the population participates in the democratic process. But I would say that those who were politically minded were very polarized and were either anti-fascists or pro-Nazi. And there were affinities with National Socialism even in bourgeois circles. For example, in 1933, two bourgeois parties, the Liberals and the Farmers and Citizens Party, today's Swiss People's Party, SVP, formed an electoral alliance with the National Socialist Parties, which also existed in Switzerland, against the left. And that was the situation, and Bill, of course, always thought politically. And in that sense, you could only be either left or right if you thought politically. Bill was definitely on the left, and Bill later became a politician. Bill designed books that were then smuggled into Germany, camouflaged so that no one would recognize that they were about concentration camps, and so on. On the one hand, he also hid refugees and was punished for it, because it was forbidden to accommodate people without registering them. On the other hand, he resisted through his designs. For example, he made posters for the Republicans during the Spanish Civil War to raise funds for winter help. He did the typography and designed the letterhead and so on for the most important anti-fascist newspaper in Switzerland called Die Nation. He was active in this context. Incidentally, I made my first feature film about the editor-in-chief of Die Nation at the time, which is how I know this story. When I made the film, I didn't know that Bill had designed this newspaper until I met Angela Thomas shortly after the film was finished, and she showed me the maquette with Max Bill's signature on it. It was a nice discovery, and of course I immediately became a little more interested in Bill than I had been before, because he didn't talk about his involvement in the Second World War and his anti-fascist activism. nor did he make a big deal out of it.
Er hat nicht darüber gesprochen, hat sich auch nicht wichtig gemacht darüber.
Bill hat für Gunther Stölzel, später hat sie dann noch einen Schweizer geheiratet.
Bill designed the letterhead and business cards for Gunther Stölzel, who later married a Swiss man. And he exhibited her work at the Triennale in 1936 in Milan, Italy, that is, in fascist Italy, in the Swiss Pavilion, but under the business acronym SPH. So it didn't explicitly say Sharon or Stölzel. Gunther was married to Ari Sharon at the time. Bill did that, and he also exhibited books by Ignazio Silone, for which Bill had done a typography, even though Silone was on the blacklist in Italy, as he was a clear opponent of Mussolini. And Mussolini actually was at this 1936 Triennale himself, and he wanted to go into the Swiss Pavilion. He was so fat that he squeezed in through the back door, Bill said, and the Nazi Pavilion was right next door.
Und der Nazi-Pavillon war gerade nebenan.
At the end of World War II, Max Bill was appointed to the Zurich School of Applied Arts, his first teaching position, and he only stayed for a couple of months.
Der, der ihn an die Kunstgewerbeschule in Zürich berufen hat, das war der Johannes Itten.
The person who invited him to the Zurich School of Applied Arts was Johannes Itten, who had previously been at the Bauhaus in Weimar and was known for belonging to the Mazdaznan sect. Bill felt that Itten needed to be kept under close political scrutiny. He was not a fan of his at all. Bill's course was very popular, until the other lecturers became jealous because people liked going to Bill so much. One of his students, whom he continued to employ as his private assistant when he stopped teaching, was Ernst Scheidecker, who went on to become a Magnum photographer, filmmaker, gallery owner and, for a time, lecturer at the Ulm School of Design. And we know from Scheidecker that Itten wanted to belittle Bill a bit. What had he ever done? Just a little typewriter. So he actually spoke contemptuously about him, even though Bill already had quite a few achievements to his name in what we call archi-lecturing, the lettering of buildings. When Bill came to Zurich, the architects of new building there didn't let him work on their projects. They had been trained at ETH, so they considered themselves socially superior to this young guy who came from the Bauhaus with lots of ideas, and at first they only let him do graphic work, like the poster for the Neubühl Cooperative Housing Estate, the lettering on the Z-House, and the lettering on the Corso building, which still looks wonderful, like in the Metropolis, when you see the red neon lettering on the Corso building in the evening. And Bill really had to prove himself, really fight for his place here in society. And he didn't stay at the art school for long, because after the liberation of Paris, he really wanted to go straight to France to his friend Georges Fantongolo. And he had a distant cousin there, Naira Franz, who worked for Charles de Gaulle for Free France from London. She was able to get him a visa right away, which was still required for Swiss citizens at the time. And then he went to Paris as quickly as possible. Max Bill had two options, by the way. For a while, it was not at all certain whether Ulm could be built, whether the Americans would really provide the funds that were needed. If that hadn't worked out, he could have worked for the Marshall Plan in Paris, designing exhibitions and so on. And when it became clear that Ulm would be built, he delegated the job in Paris to Scheidecker.
Warum Max Bill überhaupt dort Architekt war von dieser Hochschule?
And then, of course, we come back to the famous saying that Ulm is actually the reason why Max Bill was an architect at this university in the first place, and why he then became its rector. His lectures at the end of the 1940s, which dealt with beauty arising from function and as function, and both together, that beauty also has a function, and, of course, the good form played a role in Bill's recognition. He prevailed against resistance, for example, from the Swiss Werkbund, with his exhibition Die gute Form, the good form, which then toured everywhere, and that certainly opened doors for him in West Germany.
We are already in the middle of a new phase. It is the chapter of the HfG Ulm, the Ulm School of Design. And this is where I'm bringing in Martin Mentele, head of the HFG Ulm Archive and expert on the whole story around the school. I will just shortly summarize the background that led to the Hochschule für Gestaltung to contextualize what Martin Mentele would talk about. In Paris, Bill worked for the Marshall Plan, an economic recovery program to aid Western Europe to rebuild war-torn regions enacted in 1948. For that, Bill traveled to Germany and got in touch with the newly founded Ulm Volkshochschule, an adult education center in the city of Ulm that was initiated by Inge Scholl and Otto Eicher in 1946. Inge Scholl was the sister of Sophie and Hans Scholl, who had both been part of the Nazi resistance group Weiße Rose, White Rose, and were murdered by the Nazis in 1943 after they had distributed political leaflets in the University of Munich. Scholl and Eicher therefore wanted to install a school in memory of his siblings. It should educate Germans so that the horrors of the Nazi regime would never ever happen again. Max Bill reported back favorably to the Americans about the school, but his vision of the Ulm School was a very different one. He suggested to develop it into the successor of the Bauhaus. For this purpose, the Volkshochschule Ulm had to become a Hochschule, and therefore switching from educational center without the ability to grant degrees to university with the possibility to graduate with a diploma. Bill passed the suggestion on to the Americans. To cut a long story short, because the Americans agreed to fund the school with $1 million, they were in the position to decide which turn it would take. So they agreed on Bill's proposal. In 1949, Max Bill organized the exhibition Die gute Form, Good Form, thereby actively supporting the revitalization of modernism in Germany after 1945. This way, he had already proved to be suitable to become director of the then formed Hochschule für Gestaltung, HFG, the Ulm School of Design, and to design a completely new building for the school too. The building was supposed to be situated on a hill where a concentration camp had been during the Nazi era. Bill instead decided to put the different building units on the slopey sides of the hill, thereby omitting to overbuild a place where horrible things happened to so many people. To me, this seems to have been an act of respect for the victims. Well, this is the short version of it all. If you want to know all the details, you should listen to the bonus episode with Martin Mentele that will come out in the next 2 weeks. Let's get now to Martin Mentele, who will talk about what was still Bauhaus in the HFG and what was not.
After the founding of the Bundesrepublik, there was a lot of money, which was part of the Marshall Plan, and there was a special re-education fund with about 50 million marks. And the most important person in this complex on the American side is John J. McCloy. He was the High Commissioner for Germany at the time, and he found a silent agreement with Inge Scholl saying that the American government would give 1 million mark in order to build the building if the German side would also give as much money. And so it was the big task for Inge Scholl to collect this money, which came from private and public sources. But it was really a very, very difficult task because 1 million mark at the time was a lot of money, of course. And so eventually they had everything together. So in 1952, there was a big celebration where the check was handed over in the city hall of Ulm. Already in 1953, they started the first course. And Bill could finalize the planning and they could start building.
Der Unterricht für die Hochschule für Gestaltung.
Classes for the School of Design began in the rooms of the Volkshochschule in Ulm, because the building complex itself was not yet finished. The students actively helped. Those from the architecture department were also involved in the construction management and so on. And what you feel in Ulm, and also here in this building from 1967-68, is that based on what he had learned for himself in Ulm, he simply said that he built it on volume and that it is organized in a self-sufficient way, like a village that functions within itself, and you simply have a very good sense of space. And as another architect once says about the theater that Bill built in Lausanne, the architecture doesn't disturb. Bill certainly paid attention to aesthetics, but he didn't make the grand gesture of proving himself as an architect, as other architects do.
Sich als Architekt zu verwirklichen, wie das andere Architekten machen.
Well, the building was taxed to cost 2 million by Max Bill and like had collected that money. And when he finalized the plans in December 52, he really had to sort of let down his trousers, we say in Germany. He had to write a letter. In a letter to Inge Scholl, he had to confess, well, to make it short, he says, "We are missing the third million." That's what he wrote 1 week before Christmas in 1953. And I was found it always astonishing that Inge Scholl is answering on December 24th, which of course is a very Heiligabend, is sort of sacred in Germany. And she writes a very long letter and she really can't hide her exasperation and her feelings of deception and said, well, we trusted in you. How could this happen? And she immediately suggests that they would have to look into possibilities, what could be done, what could be built at the school itself. So, for example, this is one reason why the Unstuhl was designed eventually, because they simply didn't have money to buy chairs. And I'm telling you this only because Bill had to save money wherever he could. The topological situation is slightly hilly, so we have sort of a soft rolling hill. And he's using this hill to organize the different three main parts of the building on three different levels. So we have the mensa, the cafeteria level, which is sort of the lowest level. And then we have a second level with the rector's office and the library and secretary and all these administration kind of offices. And then we have the top level with the different departments and the workshops. And they are all put in a sequence and connected through staircases. So they are not stacked atop on each other, but they are sort of sloping down the hill, I could say. And directly connected to the cafeteria part begins a corridor which connects the different student quarters and the student halls. And there we find, I think, the most striking similarity to Bernau. If you come today to Ulm, you only see one large student hall, which we call the Wohnturm, plus adjoining smaller wings for the studios, which have about two stories. And I think the student hall, the tower, has maybe eight. But Bill had intended to build three of these towers and sort of linking them together along the hillside. And this would have been very similar to the situation in Bernau. And he connected all these buildings with an open air corridor, but where you could sort of walk with a dry head into the main building. And of course, what Meyer does in Bernau, that he has a glass corridor connecting all the different living quarters, which of course is much nicer, especially in the winter. But they couldn't afford that. And I think that he never even thought about this. So these are similarities to Bernau, but there are also structural similarities to Dessau, I would suggest. For example, you can sort of wake up in the Wohnturm and via this corridor access directly the main building. And this is, of course, the same situation like you have at the Prellerturm in Dessau. You go down in the first floor, have breakfast, and then can go to your lessons or to the workshop without ever leaving the building. And this is the same idea here in Ulm. And also similar to the Bauhaus, Bill designed a couple of double houses, which were used by the lecturers, similar to the Meisterhäuser in Dessau. And the houses here are even closer to the main school building than they are in Dessau. It's maybe a 3 minutes walk to the first of them. But again, he didn't have enough money, so that he just built six units, actually, although he had intended to build more. And interestingly, and not many people know this, the first house in the sequence of houses for the lecturers, he wanted to build his own house. And this, again, not a double house, but a single house, a detached house, similar to Gropius in Dessau, who had not a double house like Klee and Kandinsky or the others, but who had a house for himself, which has been luckily restored in the last couple of years. So that's a very telling similarity to the Bauhaus, and also, I think, in a way, very telling about the personality of Max Bill. But this never came to be because they didn't have the funds to do it. And the foundation was not really happy about this idea because it was really a large house. I think it had about 300 square meters or something like that, which is a very large house. The Bauhaus building when Max Biel was studying there was brand new. And I think it must have been one of the most exciting experiences, which then would become world famous. And that can be quite influential for such a young person. I mean, he was still in his early 20s when he was there.
Of course, I'm no architecture expert. What impressed me personally was the way light was used when I was filming there, because it's very permeable, and these inner courtyards bring light into the rooms from the inside when they are large. Yes, that impressed me very much.
They at first did not really think about making it a new Bauhaus. This was the suggestion by Max Biel, and that's a very important fact, of course, because Max Biel told them very early on that he thought it not a good idea to name the school after Hans and Sophie Scholl in memory of what they did. Also because he said it's too nostalgic, it's too German, and they are not known outside of Germany as a resistance group, which is true actually at the time. And he said, well, why don't we try to reestablish the Bauhaus? Because he had studied at the Bauhaus briefly in 1927-28, and he had excellent connections with former Bauhauslers, as we call them in German. For example, Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus, 1919 in Weimar, and others. This is also, of course, what intrigued the Americans, because they knew what the Bauhaus was. Certainly also because Mohol Notch had established the new Bauhaus in Chicago, but sort of 20 years after the closing of the Bauhaus in Berlin, it was quite well known. So the Americans quite early on decided to establish also Max Biel as the founding rector. Well, so we have lots of letters in the archives that are documenting this process, because we can then follow Max Biel's ideas, who he wanted to approach to teach in Ulm. And he eventually managed to find four former Bauhauslers to come to Ulm to teach classes. And also he is discussing with Walter Gropius the naming of the school and also part of the programming, actually. And so very early on, we can find a letter where he asks Walter Gropius for permission to use the name Bauhaus Ulm. And Gropius is answering that, of course, he may do that, but he should be aware that he sort of could awaken false expectations, and he would then have to take the brunt of it, was Gropius' phrasing. And Eicher also very early on opposed the idea of calling the project Bauhaus Ulm, because he said we wanted to put our own stamp of this project. And so they decided on the name Hochschule für Gestaltung, which again derives from the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus was called in Dessau, Staatliches Bauhaus Dessau, Hochschule für Gestaltung. And so they chose this subtitle as a name for the school in Ulm. The best element where we can grasp the direct connection to the Bauhaus is the Grundlehre in Ulm, the basic design course, which is directly oriented on the famous Vorlehre at the Bauhaus, founded by Johannes Itten in the Bauhaus in Weimar. Biel managed indeed to find four former Bauhäusler to teach in Ulm, Walter Peter Hans, who taught the first course in 1953, Helene Nonne-Schmidt, Josef Albers, who came twice, and for only 1 week they also invited Johannes Itten to teach at the school. And so in the first year, again, this is important, the first year was compulsory for all students. You could not sort of jump over the first year if you had already done a similar education. And again, this is very similar to what the Bauhaus had in mind for the education of their students.
When he taught in Ulm, well, Bill was in the architecture department himself, but design was taught by Hans Güjelow. He wanted to follow the Bauhaus model. He wanted to make Ulm as if the Nazi era had never happened, as if the Bauhaus could have continued to exist, and he built on that. Of course, he had to respond to the circumstances of the time, but the needs were similar to those after the First World War. There was simply a lot of destruction, many ruins, and people had no money. So we really had to design with minimal material expenditure, but still with beautiful form. And 25 years after the Bauhaus, he had met Annie and Joseph Albers again in Lima, Peru. Bill was accompanied by his first wife, Binya Bill, who was a photographer and cellist, and both couples were interested in Latin American culture. Bill was able to convince Albers to come to Ulm for guest lectures. Albers came twice. As an American citizen, Albers wrote a report in English to the High Commissioner in Germany, John J. McCloy, about Ulm, how he worked there, how many teaching hours, how many students, which countries they came from, because the School of Design had more foreign students than other universities, and there were also more foreigners on the teaching staff than elsewhere. And so Albers wrote that Max Bill was doing a very good job there.
Und Albers hat dann also zugunsten der Amerikaner geschrieben, dass Max Bill da seine Sache ganz gut mache.
Max Bill always believed that art could be a guideline, could be a guidance for designers. Although they were sort of stressing the point that the Ulm School of Design was not an art school. This is, again, a very important fight they fought because they said, we need to educate industrial designers. But Bill was nevertheless giving the arts the sort of the first role within design. And this idea was opposed very much by the younger generation. And ironically, it was Thomas Maldonado who, together with Eicher, were chasing Max Bill away. So in 1954, Maldonado arrived at the school. Thomas Maldonado came to Switzerland because he was interested in Max Bill and wanted to write a book about him. And also, interestingly, in 1948, when first Otto Eicher and Inge Scholl visited Max Bill, on the same day, Thomas Maldonado was also at Max Bill's house. And so these four people met at this occasion, not knowing what they would be doing some years later. And so in 54, Maldonado joined the school on the invitation of Max Bill. And in 1955, he already was head of the Grundlehre and introduced his own set of assignments. They were, again, completely different from Peter Hans, from Albers, and, of course, from Itten. And they were a group of assignments where I find you had to understand them intellectually before you would even be able to put pen or pencil to paper. So what we can find here is that he is pushing the idea of establishing design, industrial design, as a scientific discipline rather than an artistic discipline. So later in 58, and at that time, Bill had already left, but I guess these ideas were already there within Maldonado's thinking. In 1958, Thomas Maldonado gives a lecture in Brussels on the occasion of the World Fair, and there was a design conference on this occasion. And there he talks about the Bauhaus, but also about the fact that he thinks the Bauhaus was no longer valid as a guidance for the design education. And of course, this is a very elaborate discussion, but basically he says that the Bauhaus was still too much like an artist school and the products they designed were too much relying on arts and crafts rather than industrial production ways. So they should no longer use the Bauhaus as a guideline, but they had to develop their own guidelines. And he gives the Ulm School as the ideal school at the time, at least, for this kind of new design education. And so what comes out of that and out of this discussion is a model which the Ulm School later called the Ulm model. But this intense opposition to the ideas of the Bauhaus was really chasing Max Bill away. But of course, Max Bill was not being chased away so easily, I would say. But there was a big conflict also within the school. And the whole conflict sort of exploded because apparently Max Bill had put a sign on his rooms saying Atelier Max Bill or Atelier Bill, meaning class of Max Bill, sort of a members only entry. And this, of course, was opposed to the idea of the school with very low hierarchies and, of course, not a typical master class system like they had at the traditional art academies, like a Beaux-Arts tradition. Because he had already stepped down as a rector of the school in 56, and then they had established a group of rectors, including Maldonado and Eicher and two others, and they wrote a letter to him and said, well, what you are doing is not within the guidelines of the school. You are interruptive of our ideas, and you give the impression of a school within the school, and we don't want that. Please stop it. And Bill did not accept this, and so in 57, he left the school altogether. But he took about 20 students with him, who then sort of worked out an agreement with the directors of the school in Ulm that they would be able to take their diploma within the Bill Atelier in Zurich. Some of them did, not all of them did. And so you see, this was already a very explosive situation. But some of the students had expressly come to Ulm because they wanted to study at the new Bauhaus with a former Bauhäusler and, of course, with Max Brill. And again, you see here his prominence and his being well known within the art and design world at the time.
Wahrscheinlich der größte Fehler, den Bill gemacht hat.
Probably the biggest mistake Bill made was that he had no experience as an educator and was probably not particularly skilled in that area. He was skilled in his field with what I call das absolute Augenmaß, which is a creative ability. But he wasn't there enough. He may also have done too much. His presence wasn't as strong as it could have been. His mere presence in Ulm allowed others to somehow create and expand their areas of influence and power, pushing Bill further and further back. Bill probably should have lived there, but he still lived in Switzerland and commuted back and forth. He really should have taken up residence there, been present, and kept things under control.
Und hätte das unter Kontrolle halten müssen.
Although it might seem that after he left the Ulm School of Design, there was not much that Bill did, but that is not true at all. There's far too much that creative and ever-working artists did to name it all, but here are some of the most important things. After his directorship of the HFG Ulm, Max Bill returned to Zurich. He will again take up a teaching position, this time as a professor for environmental design at the Hochschule für Bildende Künste in Hamburg. That was from 1967 to 74. In addition to his teaching, he also published several books, as for example a biography about the third Bauhaus director, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. He held international lectures about architecture, design and art. Max Bill, as Erich Schmidt mentioned earlier in this podcast episode, was also a very political person, a leftist by heart. His engagement in the resistance during World War II was not the last thing he did. Already in the 1950s, he got involved with environmental protection issues. And from 1961 to 68, Bill was a member of the local council in Zurich, and from 67 to 71, of the Swiss National Council. His Ulmer Hocker, the Ulm stool, and the design of the timeless watch faces for Junghans wristwatches, kitchen and wall clocks became design icons of the 1950s and 60s that all of us still know today, and most of us love them for their simplicity and reduced beauty. While being an architect and designer by profession, Bill created a vast number of drawings, paintings and sculptures according to concrete art, a movement that he had co-founded in the 1930s and about which we've already talked earlier on. When I asked Erich Schmidt, a proclaimed admirer of Bill's concrete art, which was his favorite piece of art by Bill, he immediately said that it was the pavilion sculpture from 1983 at the Zurich train station. It was also Max Bill's favorite work.
Die Pavillon-Skulptur, das ist eine Skulptur, die man benutzen kann.
The pavilion sculpture, it is a sculpture that can be used. Not everyone understood this right away. At first, people thought they weren't allowed to sit on these granite blocks, which were specially arranged at seating height. I think there are about 64 elements, all identical. It was 18 gates through which you can move. Bill said he wanted to do the opposite of a labyrinth. Aesthetically, it is a connection between the small-scale old town on a square in Zurich and the large-scale banking architecture on the other side. He called it a Noten im Raum, a knot in space or in a room. He wanted to counteract the confusion in which we live today. So, transparency comes in with the opposite of a labyrinth. Freedom comes in, the freedom to use it and how to use it. And the same elements, equality, freedom, and transparency, are actually the alphabet of democracy if you want to make it work. So, imagine when the bank manager sits on one side, and on the other side, the sculpture is about 30 or 40 meters long, I think, sits the road worker. Then the bank manager can't buy anything in it, and the road worker doesn't have to pay anything. So it's a sculpture that people can use, where they can hang out without having to pay anything. That's nearly impossible on Bahnhofstrasse, probably the most expensive street in Europe with all those fancy shops. It's almost impossible to walk down that road without spending some cash. But here, you can just be without paying anything, and it's a nice place. I can only recommend sitting down there and getting a feel for the aesthetics of this connection between two urban spaces and seeing how these granite blocks, which reflect everything that moves around them, when the tram arrives, suddenly they start to vibrate. At the very least, the harmony, the beauty, that is a service to society, and perhaps even something close to a model service, which I think is magnificent. Bill would have wanted to be buried there, he said, and Angela did it posthumously by scattering his ashes there. It's a criminal offense, but the statute of limitations has expired.
Die Asche dort verstreut hat. Es ist strafbar, aber es ist verjährt.
Max Bill received several prizes for his artwork, and there is even a school in Berlin today that named itself Max Bill School for planning, building and designing. I guess he would have loved that, to see his different professions unified in one school. And it was also here in Berlin where Bill died on 9th of December 1994. He was about to return home to Angela Thomas when he realized at the counter of Tegel Airport that he had lost his ticket and then suffered a heart attack of which he died. Max Bill was an anchor point around people of the Bauhaus during the Resistance and then later at the HFG Ulm. He was an inspiring teacher for many and became one of the leading designers of the 20th century and one of the best-known artists of the small country between Germany, France and Italy, Switzerland. But he was also a workaholic, as his wife Angela told me, always relaxing with one art from the other. And he was very good at organizing his life and always finding time for women too, as she said with a smile on her face. I would like to thank Angela and Erich for inviting me to their home in Zumikon, showing me around and talking to me for hours. It has been an inspiring journey for me to get to know Max Bill much deeper than I ever imagined before. And thank you, Martin Mentele, for readily sharing your knowledge about the Ulm School of Design and Max Bill's role in it. Although, as you might have noticed, the audio recording did not work out without difficulties. I'm sorry about that. Both interviews were much longer than what you've heard in this episode, and I urge you to look out for the bonus episodes that I will publish in the next 2 weeks for you too. Here you will hear everything else that didn't make it in this episode, because otherwise it would have been another three-parter. I urge you to go and see Erich Schmidt's wonderful documentary called Max Bill, das absolute Augenmaß. Max Bill, The Master's Vision. It's a great film about an inspiring and multifaceted person. The next film screening will be on 17th of October 2025 at HFG Ulm, and another one on 28th of October 2025 at the Schädthalle in Zug, Switzerland, just in case you happen to be around. We have mentioned many more Bauhäuslers in this episode, like Josef Albers, Gunter Stolz and Hannes Meyer, and maybe you would like to know more about them too? Please go on the podcast website, bauhausfaces.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you are getting your regular podcasts, and find episodes of Bauhaus Faces about them too. And keep on recommending and liking Bauhaus Faces, which really helps, and I see that in the continuously growing number of listeners. You can also follow me for bonus material on Instagram, where I am at Bauhaus Faces Podcast. As always, I will link all relevant materials and websites that I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.